morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Christopher Lovell for the appellants. Pro-competition policies have swept through federal legislation for the last 30 years. This appeal involves the pro-competition policies of the Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act, which were so strong that the conference report, the final conference report for the act, said at page 167, choosing one example to say what would not be preempted in the state laws after this act was put into force to regulate the railroads or deregulate the railroads, state antitrust laws are an example. State criminal antitrust laws, that's right, Judge Rogers, are an example of what is not preempted. The dumbed down STB, Surface Transportation Board, which doesn't have anywhere near the powers that the ICC did previously, has interpreted page 167 of the conference report repeatedly to drop criminal and to say state antitrust laws are not preempted.
Yeah, but that doesn't do very much for us. It's not authorized to enforce the state criminal antitrust laws, right? Which would be necessary, I would think, to trigger any kind of Chevron deference.
It would
have had no occasion to make holdings on the issue anyway, right?
Well, Your Honor,
How could it make a holding on that proposition?
Well, Your Honor, I would come at it from the other perspective with the greatest respect. I think they do construe the act they operate under, and it could be dicta, I suppose, but they do construe what their powers are, and when someone comes up...
Their powers don't include filing state criminal antitrust claims.
Totally agreed, Your Honor. They don't go anywhere near that, but they do, Judge Williams, have to determine whether they can look into a private contract dispute, and they do know, as a fact, that there used to be 35 railroads in the United States who are having trouble making money, and now there's four that have 90% of the traffic who are making so much money that Warren Buffett has bought one, and they do know that the act that they're created pursuant to is a pro-competition act, and they have said, as the conference report,
Motor Carrier Act of 1980, was it not?
The Staggers Act?
No, the Motor Carrier Act. I invoke the Motor Carrier Act of 1980 because we have a Supreme Court interpretation of it.
But Your Honor,
quite useful.
Well, Your Honor, 49 U.S.C. includes the FAA, the Motor Carrier Act, which we have Supreme Court.
My point is that the Motor Carrier Act of 1980 was highly deregulatory, highly pro-competitive, and pushed very much on those grounds. On the other hand, the Supreme Court held in Square D that it did not reverse the Keogh decision of 1922, right?
Correct, but it's...
So despite the fact that, linguistically, or not so much linguistically, but in terms of the shift of context, you could make an argument that it would make sense to replace the strong ICC regulation with strong antitrust.
Well, I think that the statute here and the conference report here are totally different than in the Motor Carrier Act, Your Honor. The key is that here they wanted the state antitrust laws to apply.
Well, could I ask you to start with the language of the statute instead of the conference report? Tell us how, given the language in this, what in the language of the statute supports your view here? Tell me what you...
Well, Your Honor, I would refer to three provisions.
Yeah, why don't you take each one of them?
The very first provision, the very first subpart, 101.1, says that the purpose, that is the policy of the United States government to allow competition to establish reasonable rates. And four says to ensure effective competition.
Well, that's a policy statement.
The appellants would argue, Your Honor, that the whole statute has to be interpreted together.
Of course it does, but to get binding law, you need something more than a policy statement. You can use a policy statement to interpret a binding statutory provision. So
directly to the preemption.
Now, what's your strongest argument?
Our strongest argument
about the language of the statute producing that the statute does not preempt state antitrust laws?
Our strongest argument, Your Honor, is 10501B and the language of that applied to the class of unregulated contracts that under 10709C1 the STB can't regulate.
So that's your first accept clause, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. We see if I may read the language, just to be clear, except as otherwise provided in this part, the remedies with respect to regulation of rail transportation provided in this part are exclusive. So we see two giant holes in this language. With respect to regulation, we've cited a whole line of cases, including in our supplemental authorities, that define regulation as manage and govern. In our case, we have the one example they gave in the conference report that is not manage and govern. It's to further the pro-competition policy. We cited the Florida East Railway case, and then recently there's the on-bank decision in Frank's Investment from the Fifth Circuit. And there's also been other circuit courts that have held that this language is not preempting laws of general applicability.
From the briefs filed by you and other counsel, I've found three circuit cases dealing with the question of whether tort remedies at state law survive with respect to purely economic disputes between carrier and shipper. And they all come out saying, no, they don't survive. I'm talking about PCI Transportation, G&T Terminal, and Port City Properties. So all of those in the face of elimination of STB remedies. So, I mean, the idea that the elimination of STB remedies necessarily opens the door to all kinds of other things, such as state law, seems to me wide of the mark.
Judge Williams, none of those cases involve private contracts under 10709C1. All involve the operation of the railroads that are directly under the STB. None of the cases cited by...
The railroads are under the STB, but I think it's the case that in all of those instances, there was no STB remedy for the conduct involved.
I won't argue that point with Your Honor. What I will say is that under 10709C1, there's a whole class of contracts between the shippers and the rail carriers as to which all the transportation under those contracts are not subject to this part.
They're not subject to this part, but that doesn't mean that they open up state regulation.
Pardon me, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I didn't hear
you. I said that, of course, they're not subject to this part, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the consequence of that is that they're now available for state regulation. I mean, under your theory, the defendants point out that if you're right about 709, that you could have wholesale state regulation of, 80% of the freight transportation in the country now.
Your Honor, that's not this case. This case is the conference report, page 160.
No. I asked you to talk about the statute.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and I was just... I mean, what's your answer to the defendant's argument that, at least with respect to your 709 argument, you would open up extensive state regulation? Maybe your answer is yes, that's exactly the consequence of it, right?
No. I'm not saying that that's a necessary consequence. I am saying that where 10709 says that a contract that is authorized by this section and transportation under such contract shall not be subject to this part may not be subsequently challenged before the board.
Before the board.
That constitutes an exception under the preemption language of 10501B, except as otherwise provided in this part.
I understand. But my question relates to the consequences of that argument. I understand your argument. Your argument is that that's the otherwise provided under 501, right? Except as otherwise provided.
But the that's correct.
Defendant, I'll try once more. The defendants say, if you're right about that, then you're opening the door to wholesale state regulation of 80% of the freight rail transportation in the country.
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
The first sentence of 10501B says that there's exclusive jurisdiction over the rail operations.
Can the states regulate the rates of these contracts? The prices of the contracts? Why not? Under your theory.
No, I don't know if my theory doesn't prove more than my case.
But cases have consequences. I realize you want to limit it to your case, but no. if under your theory, the states are free to apply their consumer protection laws and principles of unjust enrichment, then presumably they can apply any laws.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think that for the private contracts, that may be possible. But for everything else, any law that generally collides, that manages and governs the operation of a railroad, is preempted.
Could the state set the rates of these contracts? Could it provide regulations for maximum rates for 709 contracts? For these contracts?
I think that under the exclusive jurisdiction sentence, there might be a problem with that, Your Honor, but I'm not saying that there is, because to be honest, I can't see one right now.
Really? Can I just ask you about in 10709B, where it's talking about a party to the contract shall have no duty in connection with services other than those specified by the terms of the contract? What do you do with that language as far as your argument is concerned about you can have remedies beyond the contract?
Well, I think the contracts, we never got to that in this case because there was no discovery. This was decided on a motion to dismiss, Your Honor, as an express preemption. But I think the answer is that the contracts specify the law that governs. And what you find is that when there is a dispute, again, I think the point bears emphasizing, there's never been a preemption decision involving the private contracts. It's never been asserted that I know of. But when there is a dispute, the parties have selected a law, and that law applies as a matter of contract.
Right. So doesn't the answer to Judge Tatel's question have to be yes, you are opening up the railroads to this patchwork of state regulation under your theory? If you take that language plus the shall not be subject to this part language in your argument, isn't...
I don't think so,
no,
Judge Rogers.
Just tell me why not.
I just think it depends what the contract supplies. I think that's what we just went over.
The railroad and the shipper agree that the state law of Alabama shall apply. All right, so suppose Alabama has laws on the books that say any railroad coming through our state, the rate shall be X. Isn't that the result of your theory?
Well, it's not my theory. I don't go that far. But
you've got to articulate an interpretation of the statutes that gets you where you want to go without getting where you seem to be leading the court.
I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttals, Your Honors, and I may address that on rebuttal, but I'd like to use all my time up because I've gone over.
We will give you time on rebuttal.
Okay.
But just answer our question.
Well, I think if the theory of the pro-competition policies of the ICCTA is that if the railroad made a contract that said Alabama law applies to this, and if Alabama has a law that says thou shalt not charge more than this for this time, I think it would be a serious question whether that's preempted or not.
Why aren't your... I see your point about state antitrust laws, about their applicability, but I can't get to where you are on your other two counts, unjust enrichment and consumer protection laws, your consumer protection claim, because those to me look like essentially challenges to the rate, to the surcharge.
I have to concede that I've always had a different level of confidence in those two claims than the first, but
you mean
I don't.
Less? Do you mean less?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, the less level. I do mean less. Yeah. But I think that when you look at the language of the statute, except for the conference report,
but you see, let's talk about the language of the statute. Okay, it says with respect to regulation of rail transportation. You know, it looks to me like your consumer protection and unjust enrichment counts, that's in fact what they are. You're applying state principles that, quote, that that are with respect to rail transportation?
Well, the unjust enrichment claims have been held not to be preempted before. We cited the case in the brief. I'll get it wrong, and I'll say that on rebuttal. So the unjust enrichment has a point of data support that the antitrust, if you take out the conference report and the STB statements, do not.
What is that?
Well, I'll get the case. Right now, I think it's the Emerson case, but I don't remember for sure. There is a case that we had an unjust enrichment claim and said this is not preempted, and it's in a court of appeals decision.
But not this court of appeals.
No, not this court of appeals.
All right.
And so just one more question. And so the defendants say, you know, that's even true with respect to your antitrust claim because, you know, ultimately you're going to, if you win, you're going to have to decide what the rate should have been absent the antitrust violation. So it's essentially the same, they argue.
Judge Tatel, I mean, so would the government, so would the state, in the state antitrust case, in a criminal case, they have to show that there's been a violation. They have to show that there has been conspiratorial.
I just want you to talk about the language of the statute.
That's my strongest point, I think. Okay.
Answer that question for me.
The question being,
the question is in the
you
brief.
Have to prove.
It's in the red brief. They say. Okay.
You have to prove that the.
You're going to have to ultimately prove the proper rate anyway.
Here's what you prove, Your Honor. You prove that there's a conspiracy.
Yeah, I understand.
And if you don't prove
I
the conspiracy.
Antitrust law. I'm not asking you that question.
But Judge Tatel, they're characterizing the issue, and you're accepting their characterization. Maybe you're right, but I'm just saying.
I suppose you
from
win.
From my point of view, here's what I have to do. Yeah. I have to show there's a conspiracy. I have to show the impact of the conspiracy.
How do you show the impact?
Yeah.
The amount of the impact is the difference between what the conspiracy charged and what would have been charged in what the ICCTA wanted, a competitive market. Now, I don't see how I intrude on any federal policy when I'm implementing 101011, 1014, 1079C. I'm trying to get at what they want, which is prices determined by competition. I'm not regulating them and say, thou shalt charge this. If they hadn't entered a conspiracy, they wouldn't have to put their expert in to show it would have been a different thing under the pro-competition policies of the ICCTA.
It's true that the de facto lawful rate would be computed differently from the way in which regulatory agencies historically, and perhaps in any case, have calculated lawful rates. But it has in common with them that it is an externally determined rate, right? In other words, it's determined by experts saying, hypothesizing various things, and so forth. It is not a market rate. You say it's better than a market rate because this is a distorted market. I understand that. But it still has in common with a regulated rate that it is externally determined.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have to agree. You know, I do. It's just as an ancillary to the amount of damages.
It may be ancillary.
But you're right.
It may be ancillary, but it's doing something in many respects similar to what a rate-setting agency would do.
I think the way Your Honor explained it is there are differences. You don't go into cost-plus and you don't do all that. You do a competitive thing and look at where competition would have been, and you do it totally differently from a rate-making.
You know, I mean, one of the ways you figure out what the competitive rate would have been is to look at costs, right? That begins to look like ordinary rate-setting.
Yeah, well, I have to plead that we have guilty that we have done that in some cases, but it's not the common way that we do it. Instead, we use the competitive prices before and after the conspiracy, and that's recognized in the ABA manual on jury trials as the way to do it. It's this, you know, in the federal and the state.
But if there are changes of costs in the interim that coincide with your before and after comparison, you'd have to take those into account, right?
Well, only because the defendants entered into a conspiracy. The states are not trying to make them charge this price. By default, conspiracies have always been dangerous.
Can I ask one question? As you described this in your brief, it looks like a horrific violation of contract, and what I want to know is why it isn't that?
Well, Your Honor, it may be.
I mean, all your clients have indirectly deals with the railroads, and suddenly, instead of one perfectly logical way of computing the impact of an increase in the price of fuel, you have a very dubious way introduced. So why wasn't that covered by the contract?
Your Honor, we don't have the right to sue under the contract because we buy from the freight.
I understand that, but what I'm trying to get at is why, on your description of what happened, there isn't a monstrous and obvious contract violation.
The direct purchasers did not sue on the contract. They sued.
You weren't answering my question.
No, I'm not. I'm saying that no one has chosen to do that. I don't know what all the contracts provide. I don't know that there's a standardized uniform contract. I suspect that there has to be a restraint of trade defense so that a shipper could get out of a long-term contract. I agree with you. Not suspect. I would think it. As an antitrust guy, I think that has to be true. What would the damages be to compel them?
Quite apart from that sort of defense, I understand how that might work, but even if one railroad alone had done this, what you describe, as I say, sounds like a monstrous contract violation.
Unless
the contract is really badly drafted.
I don't know if you can get damages in that type of breach of contract situation to say, you should have charged me this way of computing fuel. And I think you have to go to ex-contract. Depends on the language of the contract. It could be. You could be totally right.
I've tortured you enough. So.
All right. Why don't we hear from Appelese?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Alan Wiseman with Howery, representing Union Pacific, and I'm speaking on behalf of all defendants. What plaintiffs propose as a consequence would be a radical change in what has happened over the last 100 years, where you have had pervasive oversight of the railroad.
Well, suppose they're right. Suppose they're wrong about everything except the state antitrust laws.
They're wrong on that as well.
Then it wouldn't be quite as dramatic a result as you suggest. Correct. In fact, federal and state, aren't I right that with respect to these agreements that are unapproved by the agency, you could always bring state or federal injunctive actions, correct?
No.
No?
You could not bring state actions. If I'll turn directly to the language of the statute.
Is there a case that says that?
Yes, there is. Where you have a 10709 contract, in one of the cases, they sought a breach of contract claim and injunctive relief, and the court said the injunctive relief was
outside. How about
outside
a contract that's not approved under 709?
I thought he was talking about 10706.
I'm talking 10709.
Yeah, 709. Suppose it's not approved. It's just an agreement in restraint of trade set rates. Couldn't plaintiffs always bring injunction actions?
No. Not under state antitrust law.
What case says that?
Let me give you an example of what the plaintiffs are seeking here. They are claiming a conspiracy to impose surcharges that were too high, but their underlying assertions are that the railroads should have used a mileage-based system rather than a rate-based system. Uh-huh. So for injunctive relief at the state level, you would be seeking to change the conduct of the railroads. And there, in 100 years, there has never been a state case that has been allowed. You can go back to 1907, where the Supreme Court barred certain common law claims, saying that they, in essence, were preempted by the federal government. And that has been consistent. I'm sorry?
Which case is the 1907 case?
It would be Texas and Pacific Railway versus Abilene, 204 U.S. 426, Your Honor. And then there was a second Supreme Court case in 1981 involving Calo Brick, where they refer back to the Abilene decision and basically say that decision has never been overruled. And then you have the G&T terminal case, a Third Circuit case in 1987 that was then dealing with the Staggers Act.
So your point is that the remedy here would be an order directing the railroads to change the way they calculate the surcharge?
Yes, okay. Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't there the federal antitrust case in this case is going forward, correct?
Yes.
Well, won't that be exactly the same calculation that has to be made there?
Yes, and the difference, well,
Your
Honor,
what's the difference?
The difference is that under the federal system, the antitrust laws are deemed to be, you're supposed to interpret them consistent with other federal laws, and here we have not asserted that there would be any preemption of a federal antitrust law
I understand why you haven't done it, but wouldn't the calculation be identical? Wouldn't the remedy under the federal antitrust laws be the same?
Not necessarily, because
why?
The plaintiffs are claiming violations under the antitrust laws, unfair competition laws.
No.
And they could be seeking, if you think in terms of 50 states having different statutes, now they didn't bring it under 50 states. They only brought 60 different claims under about 30 states.
Yeah.
But each state, in theory, if you followed what they're saying, you could have cases brought in state court around the country, each challenging the conduct of these railroads in terms of how they went about calculating fuel surcharges. And the STB, which triggered this case.
Well, wait, but it's not about, quote, how they went about calculating them. The basic question is, did they calculate them through an unlawful agreement between them? You wouldn't have to get to the rate question at all to litigate the question of whether there was an unlawful agreement. That's the first question.
Well, you have to also prove injury. And
I understand that, but at least at the first level, there's no consequence for rate making at all. It's just a straight antitrust claim, and I guess I thought that you could always bring those.
Well,
you
Your Honor, that's not the case, if you go to the statutory language, Judge Friedman was right. The statutory language is clear, and I'll go through the specific provisions that...
But I want to pursue this question of remedy that Judge Tatel is getting at. First place, just as a practical matter, what is the remedy that the STB found with respect to transactions that it regarded as...
It refused to apply the remedy retroactively.
Right.
And it said prospectively it thought that the better way to calculate fuel surcharges was based on mileage rather than rate-based. And it recognized that the railroads could appropriately have relied on the rate-based system, which was approved by the ICC in 1970s when there were similar proceedings over fuel surcharges. The STB, one of the other challenges they make is we had an index, a cost index, it's called RCAF, and the AAR published a new index that took fuel out of that index. There was no fuel in it, and it was called AIILF. They challenged underlying, saying that was pursuant to conspiracy. The STB said it was totally appropriate to have a fuel surcharge and where you take the fuel out of RCAF so you would avoid double dipping. So that's why I say the underlying conduct that they are challenging as part of the conspiracy was part of the STB proceeding in which the STB said part of it was perfectly okay and other part was okay in the past in light of earlier ICC decisions.
The remedy going forward was a ban on a particular method of computing and applying the fuel surcharge?
Well, it directed the railroads that with respect to certain traffic that they should come up with a mileage-based fuel surcharge system. And indeed, the STB said that this whole system could have been identical for all four railroads. It happens in our case that these different indices were different among the four railroads. But the STB in its proceedings said it's perfectly logical some shippers would prefer that the railroads all have the same mechanism in calculating fuel surcharges. Now, there's an obvious reason for that, Your Honor. If you look at the map that we provided in the Volume 2, which is at page 374, it shows that none of these railroads serves the United States entirely. There are constant interconnections. There's constant interline communications that are necessary. And so it's perfectly logical from the STB's perspective that these four railroads could have had the identical fuel surcharge, but they did not, in fact. Now, if I may go back to the statutory language, because the statutory language, I think, is the beginning and ending of the analysis here, even though the legislative history supports us. The statutory language, 10501, which we have excerpted at page 382 of volume 2 of the White exhibit, it says the jurisdiction of the board over transportation by rail carriers, that's us, and the remedies provided in this part. There are various remedies provided in the statute where, for example, shippers can claim rate discrimination or unreasonable rates. So this first sentence deals with both jurisdiction and remedies.
And all of these qualifications or limitations in there, where it says with respect to our terms of art.
Yes, with respect
to rates and then practices.
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to rates, for example, the Supreme Court in the airline deregulation statute, the statute is slightly different. There they said relating to rates, and the court interpreted relating, which I would say is synonymous with respect to, as to be anything basically that affects rates. And practices would be, for example, the indices that were used. And it says R is exclusive. Then in the second sentence, and we submit you should read both sentences together, but it doesn't really matter. But in the second sentence, it says, except as otherwise provided in this part, and I'm going to explain that in one moment, the remedies provided under this part with respect to regulation of rail transportation are exclusive. Now, if you read that section with 10709, which we have excerpted at page 396 of the joint appendix, what does 10709 say? 10709A says, one or more rail carriers providing transportation subject to the jurisdiction of the board, that's us, under this part may enter into a contract. We are being authorized to enter into these contracts with one or more purchasers of rail services. Then it goes on in page 397 of the appendix of 10709C1, it says, a contract that is authorized by this section, that's what I just read, was authorized for us to do, transportation under such contract shall not be subject to this part and may not be subsequently challenged before the board. What does shall not be subject to this part mean? It means that where if you hadn't entered into a contract, a shipper would have had the right to challenge the rate as being unreasonable or discriminatory. You're giving up that right to challenge that before the STB by entering into a contract. And so then what remedy do you have in connection with the contract? Well, if you go on to 10709C2, it says the exclusive remedy for any alleged breach of contract entered into under this section shall be an appropriate state court. Now, go back to section 10501, the except as otherwise provided in this part. The except as otherwise provided in this part is the 10709C2 remedy of a breach of contract. Otherwise, state remedies are preempted. So these two statutes were written hand in glove. They aren't off in left field, and I don't...
Is the argument you just made, is that different than the way the district court interpreted it? I thought the district court simply said, look, it's true, 709 says they're not subject to this part, but nothing in that makes them subject to state law, right?
Right, but that's not inconsistent, Your Honor, because...
What about plaintiff's 706 argument? What's your reaction to that? Their argument there, as I understand it, is it 706?
That's the evidentiary provision.
Is it section 706 gives us some inclination maybe about what Congress meant by with respect to regulation of rail transportation in 501B?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. 10706 was basically giving the railroads evidentiary protection because, as I explained.
But doesn't 706 suggest that without approval under 706, agreements of that kind are subject to state antitrust laws?
But in that case, right?
Isn't that right?
Isn't
that what Section 706 says? It says that if it's approved, then you can't.
Subsection B.
Yeah. It says.
3B1.
It says.
Successor of a provision.
3B2.
This section was in the Staggers Act. And nobody claimed that with respect to the Staggers Act, there would be state antitrust cases.
I didn't think that was their point. I thought their point was in any proceeding in which it is alleged that a carrier was a party to an unlawful agreement, conspiracy, et cetera, in violation of federal law or any similar state law, right? You can't use these agreements.
Right.
But doesn't this suggest that if there's an agreement to set rates, to establish rates that is not approved under 706, that it is subject to state antitrust law?
No, Your Honor.
No?
Because this section,
tell me why.
As it reads, in a proceeding, indicated, in violation of federal law or of any similar state law, proof of an agreement cannot be inferred. And so all it's doing is...
Keep reading. Sub 2.
It says evidence agreement between or among such rail carriers...
may not be inferred from evidence...
But you have to read the rest of it. If the discussion agreement was in accordance with this section.
Right.
So, Mike, doesn't this suggest that if it isn't in accordance with this section, that it is subject to state antitrust liability?
Well, no court has interpreted that way, Your Honor.
Can we not talk about the courts for a minute? We're trying to understand this statute, and they argue in their brief that this suggests that Congress thought there was state antitrust liability for some things, namely, in this case, unapproved agreements on rates, and that tells us at least maybe that Congress didn't think that the language in 501 was all-encompassing, that it didn't include state antitrust laws. That's their argument.
So
don't answer it by telling me there's no case. Tell me why you can't get there under the statute. Then you can tell me about the cases.
The language is in the Staggers Act. And this was transferred from the Staggers Act. And in the Staggers Act, it made clear that what they were talking about is federal antitrust laws. And in the Staggers legislative history, it was clear they specifically said no state law or federal or state common law remedies are available.
Does it say in here then, or any similar state law?
It's the sausage making, I think, of Congress.
Well, we don't interpret statutes that way.
It's inconsistent with the legislative history of the origin of the statute.
Okay, that's an argument about interpreting statutes that I think we rarely accept.
I understand, but it would be pretty dramatic to take an evidentiary protection section and say, in the face of the language of the statute, of the state remedies are preempted, that would make that language meaningless. There would be no point to the preemption language. And in the legislative history of both Staggers and then of the 95 Act, they were making clear that they had no intention through the process of deregulation to open the floodgates for state regulation. And it's repeatedly so stated in the Third Circuit in interpreting the Staggers Act.
I accept your argument about the floodgate arguments. And, you know, as you could tell from my questions to your opponent, I agree with you about the consumer protection claims and the unjust enrichment claims. It seems to me that those are clearly preempted. I was just asking you about whether the antitrust claims aren't maybe different because not only we have this language, but also because at least the frontal attack is not on rates. It's on agreements between railroads. It doesn't sound like it doesn't sound like something, quote, with respect to regulation of rail transportation. That's why I'm asking the question.
The antitrust laws historically have involved regulation. I mean, that's the whole history, as Your Honor is well aware, where we have always referred to as the Sherman Act as the Magna Carta of our economic system, the touchstone. The Supreme Court has repeatedly said the antitrust laws reflect our national policy that competition is the touchstone of economic regulation. The obvious antitrust textbooks all say trade regulation.
How does that help you with the question I'm asking you about this, about the meaning of this phrase with respect to regulation of rail transportation?
Because this is...
I mean, we know for sure that some things are not preempted. There are some state laws that are clearly not preempted. You agree with that.
Well,
laws that have nothing to do with the movement of freight or anything like that. Those are clearly not preempted.
Well, the court is.
So the question is, where do you draw the line?
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that if regulation didn't cover state antitrust laws, then the preemption clause has been made meaningless because the whole history of antitrust is economic regulation. And the cases all talk in terms of that. And indeed, the Supreme Court has repeatedly said that state regulation is exerted through litigation seeking damages, which is exactly what the plaintiffs seek here. They said that in the Liggett case. And in the Regal case, the Supreme Court held a liability award is a potent method of governing, conduct, and controlling policy. So to interpret regulation, and I might add one other point. The very state laws that they rely on, when you read the state laws themselves, expressly refer to their antitrust and unfair competition laws as trade regulation. The California statute that they rely on refers to the law regulating and protecting private business.
I guess the question is where the statute says you can have an agreement, but you should seek prior approval of the STB. And if the STB approves it, you're home free. But if you didn't go that route, then B2 says you can have a proceeding in which it's alleged that a carrier was a party to an agreement conspiracy in violation of a federal law or any similar state law. But you think it's this next phrase, proof of an agreement, is signaling that that still is merely an evidentiary protection.
I'm not 100% certain of what I'm about to say, I hate to admit, but I think I'm right that these agreements that they were seeking approval of the STB no longer exist. 10709 contracts, which used to involve STB agreement, do not involve STB approval. And so I think that it may be that
these are these
that
rate bureaus, right?
Not be right.
These are these rate bureaus, isn't that right? That approve these things that the railroads got together and
right, and
that's
they don't
they
do
are.
That anymore.
Well, yeah.
I mean that
so
was part
the
of
my. That's what I wanted to ask you. I know we're talking about the text, but is there anything in the ICC Termination Act indicating that this 10706 was now defunct, as it were?
No, I think it was just lifted from staggers and just put in, and I don't think there's any.
Don't you have a real problem with the language from the conference report about respect to rail regulation?
Well,
it says. Well, you know what it says, right? I mean, it seems pretty clear from this that it says the exclusivity is limited. That's why we put it in there. We limited the exclusivity by adding this phrase, not state and federal law generally. And then they proceed to give an example, which is an antitrust example.
Well, but they say very strongly that the federal scheme of economic regulation and deregulation is intended to address and encompass all such regulation and to be completely exclusive. and they talk about
all such regulation of rail transportation. But as
right,
it says,
but what we're doing
not
is,
all. And so the question is, where do the antitrust laws fit in here? So I don't.
Well, in the Senate report, Your Honor, yeah, it says.
I mean, they do give this example of antitrust.
Right, but in the Senate report, it
no,
says.
No, but don't they? What I mean, this is the conference report.
Right, but they're talking about federal antitrust, or you
but
know,
wait,
they talk about
no,
police powers.
Wait, is that right? Let me see. The conference provision clarified that the exclusivity is limited. It says not state and federal law generally, period. For example, criminal statutes governing antitrust. They're not talking about federal there. They're talking about state.
Well, I don't think there is any history of state antitrust enforcement prior to this, because when they tried it, it was overturned. Now, in terms of police powers, I don't think.
I'm sorry, you said you tried it and it was overturned. I didn't see any case in the briefs in which either a state antitrust claim proceeded or was stopped.
Well, they put it in terms of common law remedies for unfair charges.
And, I'm sorry, and they being?
The courts. In the GT and G&T terminal case, there was a challenge of a surcharge for rail shipments, and the court there said the ICC jurisdiction over transportation by rail carriers and remedies is exclusive. No state law or federal or state common law remedies are available. And then they go on in that case, say, the court noted that the text of the Staggers Act and its legislative history show no congressional intention to resurrect state remedies, which have been barred since 1907 when the Supreme Court decided Abilene Cotton Oil. I mean, there's just no case law that supports plaintiff's theory. And the legislative history, where they say in the Senate report, nothing in this bill should be construed to authorize states to regulate in areas where federal regulation has been repealed by this bill. And they refer to Senator Ashcroft's speech, which of course has no weight, but he wasn't suggesting that there ought to be state antitrust laws available. He was punctuating, I want to make sure that there isn't. So to reverse basically 100 years of total federal oversight would be totally inconsistent with the intent of Congress as shown in the statutory language itself, because to go the route that the plaintiffs are suggesting, you would have to say that the preemption language is meaningless. When would it otherwise apply?
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, counsel for appellant.
I am informed that Congress provided in Section 10501(6) that rates cannot be set by the states, so that there's a separate provision of the statute that takes care of my in extremis potential consequences of our argument. In the STB proceedings referred to by Mr. Wiseman, the STB expressly said we cannot deal with the private contracts. They're not what we can address with respect to the fuel surcharges. In ITT versus Texas, the U.S. Supreme Court said if there is any ambiguity in the predecessor to the ICCTA, it should be resolved in favor of competition. And the two sections, which are now 101.1 and 101.4, were carried forth verbatim into the ICC that the ITT versus Texas relied upon, were carried forth verbatim into the statute in 1995. With respect to 10706, there still are, this is an agreement between rail carriers, if you look at the beginning of the section, and there still are such agreements approved today with respect to car sharing. And what that basically says is if you don't get an improvement for an agreement between the rail carriers, bilateral between them, you're subject to the state antitrust laws.
No, it doesn't say that. What it says is that if you're sued under the state antitrust laws, you have this defense. And then there's an argument that there's a negative pregnant, that in the absence of that defense, you're liable to the state antitrust laws.
Well, I think you're right.
But this, exactly the same negative pregnant argument was made in Square D and rejected by the Supreme Court.
With totally different language in the statute, Your Honor, and totally different.
That's very similar, but it didn't allude to state law. It didn't have to in the context of that case, because the question was a federal antitrust claim.
I don't, Your Honor, I know I'm repeating myself. I just don't think the statutes could be more different. I'm involved in some of these other cases. This statute is very different, I think. And I think the defendant appellees misread 10706 and its import. In a world of infinite resources, Congress could take the time to pass on academic questions. When Congress takes the time to say what's evidence and what's not under state antitrust claims, that to read the case under Bennett versus Spears, 1997 U.S. Supreme Court, which is one of many cases that say there's a principle of statutory construction where there's two readings. If you take the reading that gives effect to all the words and all the provisions, that's the way to go. Then I think here, this Congress has to have a purpose in taking the time to do that.
Through the same negative pregnant argument made in Square D, there you have the provision in the Reed-Bullwinkle Act saying, parties to an agreement approved by the commission under this subsection are, if the approval is not prohibited, et cetera, hereby relieved from the operation of the antitrust laws with respect to the making of the agreement. So a clear negative pregnant that where they haven't made that argument, they are subject to the antitrust laws. So then you have a federal antitrust claim made seeking treble damages for what would be a violation. And the court says, no, this provision did not revive the application of such federal claims. It's all in the context of federal law.
You're totally right.
That at least suggests to me that negative pregnant arguments in this realm are not Trump's.
Well, you could call it a moon argument that it's reflecting. And neither one of these provisions involves the preemption section of the statute.
That's
the
true.
Sun is the preemption section.
We're focusing on 10706 at the moment. So, and you
sought
correct. In your brief to get a great deal of mileage from it.
Well, you're correct that it has this, I'll say, random aspect in common with the trucking case. You're absolutely correct, Your Honor. But you have
I'm not sure that it's random. I mean, it seems to me it's the... The question really is, how far do statutory negative pregnants go in altering what has appeared to be settled issues?
But because the preemption provision is different, our negative pregnant reflects something. And when you
your negative pregnant is different because it alludes explicitly to state law. But this alludes to antitrust law. And the type of antitrust law at issue in Square D was federal antitrust law. So what? If any antitrust law was modified, revived, et cetera, it would have been that.
No, I'm referring to 10501B, the preemption provision.
I'm
different.
Just trying to explore your 10706 argument.
I'm saying 10706 is similar in structure to the trucking statute section Your Honor's referring to,
yes.
But they're reflecting a different preemption and exclusive provision, exclusive jurisdiction provision. And because the...
Actually, in Square D, the court didn't get to any explicit preemption language.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I think that the... what's going on here is that the language of 10501B controls. And that language, we divide it into two sentences. The Franks investment case says you read the second sentence first, then read the first sentence, because the sentences were in different parts of the statute to the very last version. And the second sentence involves remedies, which is what the Franks investment case was looking at. We involve remedies. Clearly, if one is to say that any damages suit is regulation, as the defendants want, then I have a problem. But if one follows the steady line of circuit court cases that uphold claims where the state law is not managing or governing, then there's not such general applicability. If one looks at page 167 of the conference report that says state laws that do not generally collide with our regulation will not be preempted,
I'd
for
like
example,
to ask you one
state
question
antitrust
about
laws.
The Sorry, two Jeff. Sentences of 10501B. You refer to some legislative history that this is in your reply brief that opposing counsel called attention to, namely the reference to the sense of Congress being opposed to balkanization. And you say, ha-ha, that was a sentence, that was a piece of legislative history relating to the jurisdiction sentence, not to the remedies section, right?
We did say
that. That's your argument.
Yes.
So is the implication that Congress is indifferent to balkanization via remedies?
Or that it doesn't consider balkanization to be when someone is under a private contract and the railroad makes that contract, that's not balkanization.
Do you think Congress has dropped its concern about balkanization with respect to interstate rail shipments?
Well, I will say this. Balkanization is not in 10101 or any other part of 10101.
It was just in the legislative history, but
It's in a second-level legislative history down here in a Senate report, whereas the statute itself says competition and the conference report says state antitrust laws. Thank you for
well, the
your
conference
time.
Report says criminal.
It does, Your Honor.
And, you know, we do interpret general language, at least in a statute, by the examples that are given. And the examples here are all criminal. So maybe that's what the conference report meant by not all state and local laws.
Well, certainly 10706 says nothing about criminal. Certainly the STB has said nothing about criminal. Certainly the language of 10501B, the preemption and the exclusive jurisdiction language, don't have any distinction. I would think the criminal is more burdensome.
What's your response to Mr. Weissman's last point that to rule for you would, I didn't write it down, upset 75 years of clear law that there is no state antitrust liability.
The railroads are hiding behind the history, which was regulated, and they're not dealing with the statute.
The railroads are
hiding behind the history when the federal government regulated everything. And of course, there's no precedent earlier. Now we have a statute that we have to look at that's in favor of competition that has state antitrust laws in the conference report.
And we have had the deregulatory impulse for 29 years, perhaps 30, depending upon when staggers in the Motor Carrier Act were adopted.
Yes.
30 years is a fair bit to go without state antitrust claims.
Well, I think the 10709C1 contracts in 1995 really got going. And I think what makes the state antitrust claims viable now, real politics, Judge Williams, is CAFA, the Class Action Fairness Act, requires them all to be brought in federal, then through the panel. Everything's brought in one court, and it makes it an economically viable claim as opposed to just one state for the cost of litigation. So I think practically speaking, there is some explanation for some passage of time before that came up. Does that answer the question, Judge Tatel? Because I'm focusing on the history, and maybe Mr. Weissman's point was broader than that.
That's your answer. I accept it.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sure I agree with it. But
thank you very much. We'll take the case under advisement.